I guess I need to unmute myself. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the webinar. We're just getting started, so I'm going to let people come in as they join. So just give us a few seconds here. And we'll just wait a few minutes for our folks to join us. Hope everyone's doing well. Looking forward to today's conversation. And, before we get started, Lori, I think I'm going to make you a panelist after all, because I'm realizing as people come in, I might not see, or did, all right, Lori, I'm promoting you to panelist. Can you hear me? And I cannot hear you.
Chris?
Yes.
We can hear you. We can see you.
Yes, I'm just wondering, as attendees are joining, do I need to let them in or do they automatically get let in?
They automatically come in.
Perfect.
Yeah,
okay.
You're all set.
I'm making you an attendee now. Okay. Awesome.
All right, thanks.
Okay, great. Why don't we go ahead and get started? I'm so excited to talk about today about ways to banish delusional altruism and increase our philanthropic resilience, especially during this time of crisis that we're in, and really, quite frankly, in all times. So my name is Chris Putnam Walker-Lee, and I am president of Putnam Consulting Group. And I've been a philanthropy advisor for the past 20 years, advising all types of philanthropists, ranging from ultra high net worth donors to leaders of grant-making foundations, corporate giving programs, public, private, family, health, community foundations of all sizes and types. And it was really advising funders for so many years that compelled me to write my second book, which is called Delusional Altruism, Why Philanthropists Fail to Achieve Change and What They Can Do to Transform Their Giving, which was just published a few months ago during the pandemic. So I'm going to talk about that parts of the book today. And for those of you that are interested, you can purchase the book at delusionalaltruism.com. It's available on Amazon and all kinds of places. But certainly, if you go to delusionalaltruism.com, you can see all the links. And it's also a great place to download some free resources, which I continue to add, one of which is a delusional altruism discussion guide. So you and your colleagues, your team, your board can download the guide for free and then use it to guide your discussion as you're reading through the various chapters. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about what delusional altruism is, how to banish it, how to increase your resilience and transform your giving at all times, including during a crisis. And I want to start by sharing a story with you. Back many years ago, when I was just graduating college, I moved to San Francisco, California, and began working for a nonprofit organization that was trying to change US policy and increase human rights in Central America. And this was back in 1999, I'm dating myself. And the big technology of the day was the fax machine, right? Brand spanking new exciting fax machine. And we used fax machines back then the way we often use social media today, which is to get the word out quickly. So we'd send fax alerts to Congress people, to our legislators, to people to encourage them to get involved and, call their congressperson or whatever it was we were working on. Sending faxes was in fact so important that we decided that we as an organization could not afford to buy our own fax machine. Instead, we would walk 10 blocks, which is about a half mile down the street, to another organization and borrow their fax machine. And then we walk 10 blocks back. So that's about a mile round trip. Or we'd take BART, public transportation. And we would do this sometimes every day, sometimes multiple times a day, and certainly multiple times a week. Now, fast forward, and I am in El Salvador. We took a delegation of donors and leaders to go to El Salvador to learn about the organizations we were supporting. We were bringing international aid with us. And again, we were supporting these various human rights organizations. who were in the middle of a civil war. I mean, this was a very dangerous time. There was a civil war. 70,000, 80,000 people had been killed. People were certainly living in extreme poverty, were being disappeared. It was a very dangerous time in that country's history. And we were there to bring our solidarity and our help. And we show up, we walk in the door, and what do you think I saw? I saw the biggest, most lovely fax machine I'd ever seen in my life. This thing could, you know, send faxes, it could copy, collate, staple, you know, practically made the coffee. And I was astonished. And I asked myself, or I asked the executive director of the organization, you know, how can you possibly afford a fax machine when you're relying on delusional altruism? And delusional altruism essentially means, as I go through these, I want you to think about your own giving, your own philanthropy, the issues and causes that you care most about, if it's increasing racial equity or responding to a pandemic or improving access to high quality early childhood education, whatever it might be. Think about how these practices might hold you back in your work and hamstring your impact. So the first delusional belief and practice is having a scarcity mindset. And this is exactly what was happening with that fax example that I just shared with you. A scarcity mindset is really the belief that maintaining a Spartan operation equates to delivering more value to the community that you are serving or to the issue or cause that you're trying to support. And I want to really emphasize that it's first and foremost a mindset. And it's kind of surprising because we think about philanthropy as having so much wealth, right? I mean, if nothing else, as a funder, you have access to wealth, either your own as a donor, you've decided that you have so much money, you have extra money left over to be able to give it away to others, or you're a professional staff person working at a foundation and you're stewarding somebody else's wealth. But regardless, if nothing else, there's money. But really this scarcity mindset, it does have to do with lack of investment, which I want to talk about in a second. But more importantly, it has to do with your mind and sort of the guises that it takes in your mind. And so some of this happens, for example, project. So we spent a fifth of the cost of the project on finding the consultant, right? It doesn't make any sense because he didn't trust himself to make a fast decision about who to hire. Again, and thinking about how this manifests in your head, funders often limit themselves based on their own current capacity and frequently believe that they don't deserve something. So, you know, this happens when you might be a small funder and you think we're a small funder, we can't have a big impact because we're so small, as opposed to thinking, well, who could we partner with and what could we leverage and where could we really, what's the kind of key issue where we can be the lever that creates the most change? Or you simply feel that you don't deserve to invest in yourself, in your own learning, in your relationship building, because often you feel guilty about having access to wealth. But a scarcity mindset also happens with a lack of investment in yourself and your grantees. And I want to talk about investing in yourself and this, the lack of investment in yourself as a philanthropist. And I'm not talking about, you know, having private jets and jetting off to Hawaii at the Four Seasons for your board meeting. I'm talking about believing that you deserve to invest in your own learning, your capacity, your infrastructure, your technology, your systems, having an executive coach, having good advice, research, whatever it might be, so that you can be the best philanthropist you can be, so that you can have the greatest impact. And then certainly there's a scarcity mindset when it comes to supporting our nonprofit partners, who we call partners, but we don't really treat them that way. And, you know, too often there's a belief that, you know, you can't spend money on overhead, or we have a lot of tight restrictions and controls on the nonprofits we support. And we don't invest in their talent, their infrastructure, their strategy, but it's really misguided because in order, you know, we want to make an impact as funders, make a difference. To do that, we need these nonprofit partners that are doing the work, right? Well, don't we want them to be the most talented, have the best financial management systems, have a great strategy, excellent execution, good communications internally and externally? Of course we do. But we don't invest in that. We have the scarcity mindset that holds us back, and it ends up just hamstringing the efforts of what we're actually trying to accomplish. In the book, Delusional Altruism, In the first chapter, I talk all about this, and there's actually a scarcity mindset quiz that you can take and quickly score yourself and see how you fare, to what extent you have a scarcity mindset. The second belief I want to share with you is, misguided belief, is a fear of losing control. I think funders really experience a lot of fear in general, and I actually have a whole chapter on this in the book, but one I want to talk about, there's eight that I mentioned, and one I want to talk about is fearing loss of control and loss of power. You know, certainly as funders, we have lots of power, right? We have the funding, we're the grantor, the nonprofit is the recipient, you know, guess who holds the power in that relationship? And, you know, as funders, we can decide what to fund, who to fund, what we expect will happen with those funds. There's a lot of power. And I think the problem here is that this is really a setup for failure. It's a setup for not having trusting relationships, not having honesty and communication between the nonprofits and the funders. It becomes more isolating for the funders, where you end up really not hearing about what's actually happening because of this power imbalance. And especially as I hope many funders are trying now, especially now, to reduce racial inequities and increase racial equity, that power imbalance is really maintaining the status quo and keeps you in an isolated bubble as a funder, and that's a problem. A couple ways that funders experience this fear of losing control is refusing to make general operating support grants or core operating support grants, which are grants, as you probably know, to, you know, really fund the organization to do what it needs to do, as opposed to tight restrictions on exactly how the money could be spent and for what programs. And I think it's a fear of losing control. The donor wants to control exactly how the money is spent and fears what will happen, even though chances are pretty good that not-profit organization, you know, knows best how to allocate those funds in their community and knows what the needs are and wants to be able to respond as things change and situations change. Donor legacy is another area where a lot of family foundations want to maintain control, you know, control of what the donor originally intended. One of my clients is a family foundation, and their donor, when he created the foundation, was so concerned about donor control that he didn't just kind of name the type of board members he wanted for the board and how many family versus how many non-family. He actually named the individuals, the non-family individuals. Now, fast forward decades later, the donor has since passed away, and these people who are named have like nothing to do with the foundation. They're not at all involved. They're in their 70s and 80s, but it's actually written in the bylaws that this is the succession of board members, right? And so it's really holding back the current leadership of the organization because they can't decide who the best board members are for them at this particular time. They have to navigate the bylaws that have named these individuals. And again, it was, I believe, based out of a fear of losing legacy, losing control over the legacy of the foundation and not trusting the future leaders of the organization. Okay, so the third manifestation of delusional altruism I see is funders simply move too slowly. Now, you might have seen a movie called Zootopia in which some animals go into the Bureau of Mammal Vehicles. It's an animated movie about animals. And they need to get into the BMV, as they call it, and quickly get some information to save their friend who is now lost. And they walk into the Bureau of Mammal Vehicles, and to their horror, they realize that the entire place is staffed by sloths. And so what follows is this very like painfully funny movie to watch, or segment of the movie to watch, because everything's moving so slowly. And what should take 3 minutes literally takes all day for these people to get, these animals to get their information. And I contend that philanthropists are a lot like those sloths. And really it's just as painful to watch them as it is to watch the actual sloths themselves. So, you know, why does philanthropy move so slowly? I think it's a bunch of reasons. Certainly lack of accountability is one of those reasons. There are not a whole lot of regulations on philanthropy. And quite frankly, funders create their own regulations and own policies and own restrictions that maybe made sense at the beginning, but often don't. And then kind of tend to hold back and slow down funders over time. So here's a couple examples. I think, you know, a lot of funders create bureaucratic bloat, where these policies, again, you know, they just sort of grow like black mold across the foundation. One funder I was talking to, their CEO was fairly new, joining an existing foundation, and she was horrified really to learn that it took an average of 9 months to make a grant for this organization. And this organization is staffed by like some fabulous, talented people, diverse, really involved, experienced, right? So it was really just that their processes had just grown on top of themselves, right? This organization actually had a written policy for how the kitchen should be cleaned. Like that's how bureaucratic it had gotten, right? And so she was able to whittle away at it. But that sort of, you know, too many steps, too many people needed to approve grants, and these bureaucratic policies just grew upon themselves. A second way that funders are too slow is that they toss in, they're trying to do the right thing, and then they just toss in a bunch of junk along the way. So one organization, one foundation was, you know, trying to create a strategic plan and then tossed a president in its way. And by that, I mean, they, as many people, were surprised when President Trump was elected. And so they decided that they needed to pause all strategy work for the next like 4 months or 5 months to kind of wait and see what would happen, even though like nobody was going to know what was going to happen. It didn't really matter. Another funder, you know, was planning on also developing her giving plan and starting her foundation, but tossed a wedding in her way. Like her daughter was going to get married in a year. And she said, oh, I can't possibly deal with this. I have to wait a whole year before I can ever get started. For me, you know, when I began writing this book, I tossed a bunch of junk in the way. What I really needed to do once I had my contract from Wiley was to start writing the book, chapter one. But what I decided to do instead was, or what I thought I needed to do, was completely declutter my house. Because how could I possibly think and write a book if my house was cluttered? And while I'm at it, I need to schedule all my kids' camps for the summer, even though that was like 5 months off. And while I was at that, I should get down to inbox zero. Like I thought I had to like clear out like everything in my life so that I could focus on this book. But all I was doing was just tossing junk in my way. I just needed to write the book. That's all I needed to do. And the third way that funders, I think, slow themselves down frequently is by complexifying the simple instead of simplifying the complex. And by that, I mean, you know, if you think about the Occam's razor, right, the whole notion is if there's two ways, given two options that basically lead to the same result, the simplest way is always the better way. And so we really need to think about how can we simplify the work that we're doing and not complexify it. So here's an example. I was working with one foundation, and one of the staff people was, others were concerned that the meetings that she ran always went on too long. If there was a 2-hour meeting, it frequently would last 3 or 4 hours. And there was rarely an agenda, and there was rarely resolution at the end, and people were frustrated and exhausted. And she was leading a pretty big initiative. And instead of figuring out like, how do I just shorten the meeting, right? She needed to shorten her meetings. Instead of like maybe coming up with like a tight agenda, sharing the agenda in advance, identifying time, keeping time, you know, basic meeting management skills, she decided to convene that group 3 different times to discuss as a group how to shorten the meeting. So she created 3 meetings in order to decide how to shorten a meeting, right? So this is complexifying the simple. She just needed to shorten it and end on time. Okay, so that's the third. The fourth is that funders are too often fooled by their own efforts. And by this, I mean that, you know, chances are pretty good that you as a philanthropist are not like slacking off, right? You're not one of the ones sitting around doing nothing during the pandemic, right? You're very, very busy. Your calendars are full. You're convening people. You're making emergency grants. You're attending webinars and learning about how other funders are responding to the pandemic. Or in regular times, you're reviewing proposals, attending conferences, planning events, going to events, meeting with grantees. It goes on and on and on. I know this because I work with you all. And so you're very, very busy, but you're not necessarily busy working on the right things. So you're fooling yourself by your own efforts. And I think too often we equate busyness with impact. And the problem here is that, you know, you're a smart person, right? You watching and listening to this, you're hiring talented people who want to make a difference and want to change the world. They're not going to slack off. They're going to keep themselves busy. But being busy, not all aligned toward the right thing, is just really wasting time. I mean, you're probably doing some good stuff, but it isn't necessarily the right stuff, and it's not necessarily aligned to get you where you want to go. So I think there's three things happening. One is funders, you know, often don't know where they want it, where they're headed, where they want to go. They lack a strategy. They lack a clear decision-making framework that helps them understand, you know, who do we want to be a year from now? What kind of change do we want to see? And, you know, what is that North Star we're headed to? Secondly, they lack a plan to get there. So they don't know where they're going, and then they don't know how to get there, right? There's no clarity around implementation or what the most important priorities are. And then thirdly, they often are suffering from what I call donor distraction disorder, DDD. And this is essentially, you know, two things happen. So absent a strategy, you don't know where you're headed. You don't know how to get there. It's very easy to get distracted and get afflicted by donor distraction disorder. So this will happen, for example, when you're, you know, the phrase chasing shiny squirrels, or chasing squirrels, chasing objects, shiny objects. But, you know, there's all kinds of interesting ideas in philanthropy. There's all kinds of compelling needs. Somebody in your community might be launching a new initiative and wants you to get involved, even though it has nothing to do with anything you've ever funded. Or you go to a conference or a virtual learning event and you learn about some new approach, if it's, you know, crowdfunding or collective impact or whatever it might be, emotional intelligence. And you think, well, that's cool. I should probably do that. Let's kind of go off on that, you know, tangent and chase that squirrel. And because you don't have a strategy, you can't compare these interesting, compelling ideas and say, you know, does this align with our strategy? Is this going to help us get to where we're going? Or is it going to take us entirely off course? Or even, you know, is this new need that's emerging in our community so compelling, we actually need to shift our strategy? But you wouldn't know that if you didn't have one, right? And so having donor distraction disorder allows you to kind of get lost chasing those squirrels. It also allows your organizations to get pulled apart from within. And by this, I mean, again, as I mentioned before, like, you didn't hire slackers. Like, I'm guessing your team are full of smart people, talented, experienced. They want to do the right thing. And absent clarity of where you all are headed and what your top priorities are, they're working on stuff, right? They're coming up with ideas. And so they might decide, you know, we really need to focus on policy advocacy. So let's add that to our guidelines, right? Or we really need to, you know, build more trusting relationships with our grantees. Again, not a bad idea. So we're going to change how we structure our giving. Or we want to shift the tech team, your technology team might decide that, you know, it's about time to upgrade our technology. And this happens often in philanthropy. So we're going to, like, on our own, without consulting anyone in the program and grant making side, we're just going to, like, research different grants management systems, pick one and buy it, right? Without any connection to what's actually happening on the program side or what their needs are, right? So by being pulled apart from within, what I mean is all of these new changes, initiatives, ideas are kind of like pulling the organization apart, right? They're not necessarily bad, but they're not helping you align and focus on where you're trying to go. The fifth is that many funders are starting with the wrong questions. And so this is another way that I think delusional altruism manifests itself, because questions are really powerful. And by asking the right questions, they lead you down the right paths. But starting with the wrong questions, you can easily get derailed. And in the book, I outline three wrong questions that I think funders too often ask. And one of them is asking how before asking what. So by this I mean, and let me just take a drink of water here. By this I mean, And this happens all the time, right? So you ask yourself, like, how do I do this? How do we improve our relationships with our grantees? Or how do we streamline our funding? Or how do we help improve arts education? Or how do we focus on, how do we address the opioid crisis in our community, right? Whatever it is, like, again, those seem like logical questions, right? But the problem is you're asking how to do something before you have clarity on what you're trying to do. So you're getting lost in the tactics before you have clarity on your objectives and your strategy. And this is a problem. And this is why often, like, strategy discussions go in circles, and probably maybe your staff meetings sometimes go in circles. Because if you don't know what your objectives are, if you don't know what you're trying to accomplish, it's very difficult to understand the how, to understand the best way to do that, right? Because there's all kinds of hows, right? If you're looking at arts education, hows could include, the how of doing that could include hiring more teachers. It could include making sure you understand the state standards, your governmental standards for education. It could include engaging local arts organizations with the school district. It could include involving the parents. It could include a lot of things, right? All of which are perfectly fine, but until you're trying to understand what are we trying to accomplish with arts education in our community, like, what actually is a change that we're trying to see, you can't possibly know the right way to get there. And so that's one of the wrong questions that I think too often funders ask. So let me just recap these five ways that funders experience delusional altruism and get in their own way. And these are just five of many that I outline in the whole first half of this book. So again, it's a scarcity mindset. It's fear of losing control. It's moving too slowly, being fooled by your own efforts, and starting with the wrong questions. So speaking of questions, I'm actually going to pause for questions and see if there are any. And so there are a couple. The first one is, why did you decide to write this book? What compelled you to want to write it? And why did you call it delusional altruism? So, you know, what compelled me to write it is one of the questions that I ask often of my clients and funders, which is, if you were to accomplish only one thing this year, just one thing, but it was to be your legacy at your foundation, what would it be? And I find it's a really helpful question, and you could all ask yourselves that question right now. If it was to be your legacy, what would that one most important thing be? And it really helps me to understand, and my clients understand, like, what's most important of all the many things on their plate, what's really that most important thing? And I asked myself that question. I asked Chris, if you could only accomplish one thing this year, but it would be your legacy as a consultant, what would it be? And immediately I said, I have to write this book. And the book was on my mind. I was thinking about it a lot, but I hadn't really made it happen. And so the second part of this question is, why call it delusional altruism? And again, for a couple reasons. One, because no one says things like delusional altruism. I just think it's funny and provocative, and it makes me laugh, and it makes others laugh. And I just thought it would be very interesting and a thought-provoking title. But again, I really do believe that the vast, vast majority of philanthropists want to do the right thing, want to create lasting change, transformative change, make a difference, leave an impact on the world, but are getting in their way and are delusional and are misguided in their beliefs and their practices. And so I really wanted to write a book. And I also believe that people don't realize it, because we're just so, you know, moving along hour to hour, week to week, year to year, we don't recognize this. And so I really wrote the book to help funders see how that happens, recognize it in themselves, and recognize that this happens to all of us. So, you know, don't worry about it. But there's things that you can do differently to change, very practical and significant ways that you can change. And so the second half of the book is all about how to have a transformational impact. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And then another question that I got is, what are some of the other ways that funders experience fear, especially when they're not in the middle of a crisis? So again, there are lots of different ways that I think funders experience fear. And there's a whole chapter about this in the book, but one of them is a fear of disappointing others. And, you know, in philanthropy, it can feel like it's all we do is disappoint others when we have to say no and turn down way more proposals and requests for support than we could possibly provide, right? It feels like it's the number one thing that we do sometimes. And, you know, I think that this can cause a lot of problems. For example, there's a lot of times, I think, when funders, when they fail to share what they've learned. So, you know, you might conduct like an environmental scan. You might be trying to decide, do we want to support mental health or substance abuse or domestic violence? You know, those are all really important issues. We only have so much money, so we're going to commission some research and understand the issues and make a decision about which to focus on, right? And so in the course of doing that, you talk to lots of people, you talk to lots of nonprofits, they all start getting excited, you might be funding their issue, but then you choose, you know, mental health, right? And now, and you're fearful that you're going to disappoint the substance abuse treatment providers and the domestic violence providers, prevention providers. And so what do? You fear disappointing them, so you just kind of hide behind all that information, right? You don't share what you've learned, because then people will, you know, be mad at you because you're not funding their issue. Why didn't you choose it? It's most important, whatever, right? But you have all this great data, useful information, best practices, recommendations that could be really helpful to those people working in the field or to other funders that might be interested. What you really should do is publicize that and share it widely and just explain your reasons for choosing the one issue that you chose and not worrying about disappointing others. Another fear is, and I think this is a really interesting one, especially right now, is fearing losing the person that you thought you were. So I talked about fearing loss of control. Another fear that's related to loss is fearing learning the person that you thought you were. And in the book, I share an example of myself experiencing this when I was in college. I went and studied in Ecuador in South America for a year and was living with an indigenous family and got really ill. I was, you know, throwing up and sick. I had scabies. I was itching. Like, I was a disaster, right? And just thought I was going to die. And I thought to myself, you know, I guess I'm not the person I thought I was. Like, I just wanted out. I wanted home, comfort, American food. You know, I just wanted to be clean and safe. And it made me really realize I wasn't quite the person that I thought I was. I thought I was the kind of person that could live in, you know, developing countries and work for the Peace Corps and do all these things. And I could do a little of that, but I couldn't do it quite the way that I thought. And it was hard because I really had to reflect on who I was and be honest with myself about how the kind of life I wanted to live and how I wanted to live it. But I think especially now, as we're looking at a lot of police brutality, institutionalized racism, white supremacy, you know, especially a lot of, I mean, hopefully everybody is looking at themselves and trying to figure out how we can address these issues. But I think especially white people are looking at these issues and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what is the racism that I carry within me? And how do I become, work on anti-racism all of the time? And how do I recognize that I'm not the person that I thought I was, that I really want to be, and I need to work on myself. And it's a fear. And so I think a lot of people, they fear unpacking who they are. And instead of embracing that so that they can grow and learn and improve, they just withdraw and pull back. And that's, I think, a way that funders experience fear. Okay, so I wanna talk a little bit more about transformational giving. So I talked about the delusions that hold us back. I wanna talk about what to do differently. And I think that in order to have a transformational impact on whatever issue or cause you care about, you really need to give in ways that create lasting change, that create sustainable change, that really address root causes. But to do that, you also need to transform yourself as a funder, as a person, and how you give. Because I really believe that how you give matters. And I think this really has a lot to do with being resilient. And especially as we think about now in this time of a pandemic and, you know, in the future, there'll be other kinds of crises we'll be going through. It's not just a matter of bouncing back from adversity, but resilience is really about bouncing forward and being able to learn from our experiences dealing with that adversity to improve and change ourselves so that not only do we bounce forward and ahead and not, you know, back to the status quo, but to improved innovative changes, right? But how are we able to consistently do that over time? And how do we kind of build that resilience muscle so that whatever that adversity is that's tossed in front of us, we don't just bounce back, but we can learn from the experience and bounce ahead. And that to me is what I think resilience is. So I have a whole many chapters in the book about this, lots of ideas about transformational giving, but I want to share four of them with you in the interest of time today. And the first is starting with the right questions. So I talk about starting with asking the wrong questions and how that can derail you. But in the book, I outline 12 questions that I think all funders should be asking themselves all the time, and in no particular order. So I'm not going to share all 12 with you, but here's a couple that you might not normally think about. And the first one is, what do I already know? Now, I believe that generally speaking, we all know about 80% of what we need to know to solve a problem or make a decision or whatever it is. But we don't take the time to think about it and reflect on it and maybe like jot it down or summarize it. We just assume we don't know something, how to do something, and then we look to everybody else for answers. But I really think we know 80% of what we need to know. Maybe you as an individual or your team, your board, your entire operation, if you got together and brainstormed, what do you know about, you know, some new issue that you think you've never tackled before? You probably know a lot about related issues, about the kinds of systems involved, experts to contact. You know, there's a lot that you probably really know if you just spent like an hour or two brainstorming that and writing it down, right? A woman that I know, she was leading a national association of foundations and then left that role and went to go run a community foundation. And one of the things she and I were talking about was planned giving and how she felt she needed to launch a planned giving campaign. But she said, I don't know anything about planned giving. Do you know anyone that I could hire, like a consultant, a planned giving consultant to help me? And I said to her, the very last thing you need to do right now is hire a planned giving consultant. And she said, why? And I said, because you already know 80% of what you need to know about planned giving. And she thought I was crazy. And I said, let's just think about this. You know all about not just philanthropy, but asking for money, because as a membership association, you had to ask foundations to join and make contributions and contribute to initiatives that you were developing. So you know a lot about fund development, which is a part of planned giving. You know all about designing campaigns, and you know, a planned giving campaign is a campaign, right? Because you've designed lots of other kinds of campaigns. You can get clarity on your goals, your strategies, your tactics, your plan, how to execute, timelines, all that. Like, you have that down. And you know a lot about communications because you've developed, you know, you were involved in communicating to your members, to the field. You have a lot of communications knowledge and experience and developing collateral materials and all this kind of stuff, right? So we brainstormed those kinds of things that she knew that were really directly related to planned giving, even though they weren't called planned giving. And she was really amazed at how much she actually knew, right? So that's just an example of, if you just take the time to and open your mind and embrace an abundance mindset and thinking about this rather than a scarcity one, you can really recognize that there's a lot that you know. Now, another question to ask is, what don't I know? So the first one is, what do I already know? And the second one is, what don't I know? Because as brilliant and awesome and talented and amazing as you are, you don't know everything, right? And you certainly don't know a lot about, you know, community needs and communities where you've never worked, or, you know, necessarily the right practices or all the options or whatever it is. You know, there was one very successful hedge fund manager who, you know, was super smart and very successful and made a lot of money, and then wanted to apply those resources and his smarts to ending homelessness. And he just assumed, well, I'm a smart guy, I'm very successful, therefore I know how to like end homelessness better than anybody else does, right? And it's clearly misguided. Now, he could be super smart. He could have lots of innovative ideas that could be very helpful in thinking about ending homelessness in ways that no one else has thought of. But, you know, he had this hubris to believe that he, you know, didn't need to learn anything else, that he was automatically smarter than people who have been working in ending homelessness for decades, some of whom were formerly homeless, right? So if you can figure out the 80% that you know, what's the 20% that you don't know? And focus on that, or just recognize that as smart as you are, there's a lot of learning that you might need to invest in. And again, invest in yourself. Banish that scarcity mindset, embrace one of abundance, where you think it's important that I spend time learning about this issue. Like, that's worth my time and effort and maybe money to really inform and equip myself and my philanthropy so that I can know where I can make a difference and I understand what's happened before me and I can offer new ways of thinking about it. Going back to that planned giving story earlier, once we figured out the 80% that she knew, we then looked at the 20% that she didn't know. And there was a lot of that. You know, there was things like she didn't know how to have conversations with people about death, you know, and their legacy, right? That's not a typical conversation that we have. She didn't know how people in different cultures thought about planned giving and legacy. And so once we figured out the 20% she didn't know, it was a lot easier and quite frankly, a lot cheaper for her to find that planned giving consultant who had the right expertise that would be helpful for her, who knew that 20%, rather than finding somebody that was really good at communications campaigns. She didn't need that. She had specific questions that she needed help with. So it really saved her time and money and got her the right information that she needed quickly. Another related question is, after you've asked, what do I already know? What don't I know? Then ask, who else needs to be involved, right? Because chances are it needs to be a lot more than you, the donor or the foundation leader, the donor advised fund, the giving circle, whoever you are. There are a lot of other people that likely need to be involved in helping you figure out your strategy or decide what issue to focus on or understand the right interventions or how to make funding decisions, whatever it is. And chances are pretty high that the people who are most impacted by whatever issue you're working on are some of the best people to involve. And there's all kinds of ways that you can do that. And I share those in the book, from, you know, an advisory role to, you know, actually a decision-making role in your organization and how you can cede some of your control and power to that. One of my clients is the David and Lucille Packard Foundation in California, and they launched a big initiative to support summer learning because kids, when they end school at the end of spring, they lose a lot of what they learn over the summer. This happens to my kids, it happens to everyone's kids, unless you really engage them in intentional learning. And so they had a whole initiative around this, and they weren't quite getting the traction and impact initially that they expected. So rather than wait, you know, 3 years for evaluation results to come in, they actually convened their group, statewide group, to discuss this and said, you know, what's going on? And they realized there are people that were missing that were not involved in their initiative, namely superintendents. So the superintendents of the schools had not really been properly involved in their whole project. And they realized that was a huge glaring missing piece that they hadn't thought of before. So they shifted their approach and began engaging superintendents, and voila, like that was got them the traction that they needed. And they really saw an uptick in impact and quality improvement and access to these programs once that happened. So that's an example of another question that I think funders ask. The next point I want to make around transformational giving is increasing your speed and agility. So we talked, of course, about how too often we move like sloths, but that's not a requirement in philanthropy. I think there's a few things that we can do as funders to increase our speed. And the first is to think like a mechanic. And really lift up the hood of your philanthropy and look in there and see what's not working. What are the barriers? What's holding you back? Where are you not having an impact? And I'm realizing as I write this that I need to plug my computer in. I should have learned my lesson, but I didn't. You know, where are the blockages and the barriers in your philanthropy? And really, you know, where's their duplication? Where's their waste? Where's their redundancies? What's slowing you down? And begin to eliminate them. And this isn't really that hard to do. You know, probably you could just ask your team, like, what are areas that we feel like we keep, you know, hitting our head against a wall, or there's too much redundancy, or it's taking way longer than it should, and unpack that and just ask them to help you come up with solutions of how to reduce and eliminate that waste and that redundancy. Another trick that I use a lot is the 50% principle. And this is basically whatever you're doing, whatever it is, staff meeting, from developing your strategy to launching a funding initiative to whatever. Ask yourself, how could we do this in half the time? And then try to do it in half the time. So if you normally have 3-hour staff meetings, do them in an hour and a half. You might need to change how you prepare for them and prepare your team. Maybe you send out emails in advance with some updates, a tighter agenda. Certainly your strategy doesn't need to take a year, quite frankly. It doesn't even need to take 6 months. It could be done in, 6 weeks. But just think about, how can we always reduce by half everything that we're doing? One of my clients, the Blue Shield of California Foundation, found it took an enormous amount of steps to make funding decisions. I mean, like an obnoxious a number. And they had these board books every quarter for their board meetings that were like 300 pages long. So it was like the stack of material. And they eliminated most of the steps, and they reduced that board book from 300 pages to 30 pages, right? Because they were able to make lots of changes to how they made decisions. And it dramatically streamlined their work. You can also increase your agility. And I just want to talk briefly about agility and what that means and how it differs from being adaptive, because they're two different things. So being adaptive means it's what we're all doing right now. We're all working from home. Change happens to us, and we are able to consistently react to that change by changing ourselves and how we work, right? So a pandemic came, we all went home, we figured out how to use Zoom, and here we all are, right? So we were able to adapt our work. But being agile is more proactive, and it means looking out over the horizon all the time and identifying what are some of the changes, opportunities that you could take advantage of, potential threats that you need to navigate around or somehow deal with, and how you can create innovative ideas. And my colleague, Amanda Satilli, she outlines agility in three dimensions. One is looking at market agility, or sort of environmental agility. So looking out at your environment, out at the market, what are changes that are happening that you can take advantage of, or from which you could develop new innovations, and constantly doing that. But also thinking about decision agility. So it's one thing to come up with interesting innovative ideas based on what's happening. It's another thing to quickly make decisions about, do we want to pursue this, or how do we pursue it, right? So quick decisions. And then execution agility, which is really, now that we've decided what we're doing, like, let's move on it quickly. And I like the 80-20 rule in this instance too, which is if you're 80% there, you move. So you've looked out at the horizon, you see opportunity, you've made some decisions about how you want to capitalize on that opportunity, and you figure out enough of it to start moving with the confidence that you'll figure out the rest of it along the way. So that is agility. Okay, the next point I do want to make is, and then I'm going to have, I think, a few more points here, and then I'm going to pause again for questions and then share a few concluding thoughts, and I'll make sure we end on time. The next one is to change systems and address inequities. And I really think that transformational giving requires funders to think about the inequitable systems and policies that are holding people back and the root causes of problems in order to create more lasting change, and how these things, these inequitable policies and systems really restrain us, exacerbate the problems, or maintain the problems. And how can you maintain and create long-term solutions to change them? So, we could do a whole webinar on systems change and policy change, and that would be fun. And maybe I'll do that in the future. But for right now, let's just say that, systems and policies are happening all around us. We exist within them all the time. Our kids go to school in our school systems, right? We go, and those systems decide things like who has access to arts education or learning specialists if your child is dyslexic. Right? So those systems are impacting us. The public transportation system impacts us. It can help us, get to where we're going, or it can hold us back if a dad can't get his kid to childcare in the morning because he has to take 3 buses just to get to work because he has a poor public transportation system. And we've, of course, seen what happened during this pandemic with public health systems that have not been maintained and strengthened over time. So you can, I think, kind of put on your goggles, like put on your systems change goggles and your policy change goggles and your root cause goggles, right? And look around you and whatever issue you're working on, think about what are the systems, the policies, the root causes, the inequities, like what is, disaggregate your data by race, ethnicity, age, gender, whatever, neighborhood, and see where there are inequities in whatever you're trying to do, and then work to address those. And that really gets at the underlying issues. And then I think, of course, you know, you're not just changing systems and policies elsewhere and root causes, you have to, and inequity, you have to look at yourself too and change yourself in order to change these systems and inequities. The Annie Casey Foundation is a funder that has done a lot of work addressing race equity and inclusion in their philanthropy. But they did that in large part and all along the way by looking at themselves and turning that equity lens on themselves as a funder and figuring out how do we operationalize equity across our entire organization. And that's a great example. And the last point I want to make here about transformational giving, and I alluded to this at the beginning, is to have clarity on your strategy and know how to prioritize what you're focusing on. And I really believe that strategy needs to be sentient. And I actually am just launching a new frame for rapid strategy development called Sentient Strategy that you can learn more about on my website, putnam-consulting.com. And really, I believe that strategy needs to be sentient, needs to be living, breathing, organic, malleable, changeable, fungible. The strategy is a decision-making framework, so it exists to help guide our decisions. And who doesn't want a framework to help guide your decisions, especially during a crisis, right? Strategy really can be based, it does not need to be, nor should it be, a year-long endeavor. Too often we have these elongated strategic planning processes. You know, you spend a year, 18 months creating your strategy, another, 3 months writing it up into a beautifully graphic design document, and then the next 5 years not really implementing it, right? We couldn't possibly have imagined what this year would bring and last year, and we don't know what next year is going to bring, right? So think about strategy as a year out. What kind of change do you want to create a year from now? Who do you want to be a year from now? Where are you today? And what are the most important driving factors that get you from where you are today to where you want to be? And using the sentient strategy approach, you can, with a little preparation, you can figure this out in like a day. It does not need to take, half a year. And you can do it virtually by spreading that day out over, three-hour interactive meetings on Zoom, just like this. And, this is really important because once you have clarity in your strategy, then you can identify what are your top priorities for doing that and align your entire team to those top priorities. What roles do they play in implementing your strategy? And this allows us, as we're working, to be able to, as your teams are all virtual especially, but even when we're back in the office or in some amalgamated kind of version of, doing both virtual and in the office work, which I think is going to be the future, you want to make sure that your team is aligned. You don't want them just busy doing stuff. You want them busy doing the right stuff and focusing on the top priorities. And if they know the organization's, your philanthropy's top priorities, then they can figure out day to day what their top priorities are and stay focused on executing them. So again, to recap, these four areas I identified around transformational giving are starting with the right questions, increasing your speed and agility, changing systems to address inequities and addressing inequities, and then really clarifying and having a very sentient strategy and identifying what your top priorities are, knowing that you can make course corrections along the way as things change. And I do want to point out that, when we're in a crisis like this, strategy that existed 6 months ago, the beginning of this calendar year, can no longer remain intact because we're living in a different world. And I really would encourage you to take a look at your existing strategies, and that's certainly something that I can help you with if that would be of interest. I do have a useful report, an article that I think you might enjoy. It's called Six Mistakes Philanthropists Make in a Crisis and What They Can Do Instead. And it really identifies a lot of these kinds of mistakes, like holding tight to your strategy, regardless of the fact that the world has just changed. And it's downloadable, it's free. You can find it on my website. If you go to sixcrisismistakes.com, you can download it. And I hope that it'll be useful in terms of your philanthropy during this crisis. Again, that's sixcrisismistakes.com. So let me just, I know we only have a minute or two left. I just want to pause for questions. And I don't actually see any additional questions. So let me just leave you with a couple things. One is, I think it's really important to reflect on the ways that you might have been delusional in your altruism. Think about, especially now during this crisis or in the future, what are some of these ways that delusional altruism is manifesting ourselves? What are some of the ways that we've been holding ourselves back? And what was the damage, quite frankly, that caused us during this pandemic? Were we not investing sufficiently in technology, so it was really hard for us to move to a virtual online environment, and we wasted a lot of time and caused a lot of stress and couldn't get money out the door quickly, for example? So what are some of those ways that are holding you back, and what are some of the ways that you have been transformational in your giving, and how has that been helping you, especially during this crisis, to improve? And then think also about the changes you can make going forward. Especially reflect on what's worked well. What have you tried new and different during this crisis that you can continue and maintain after? Because this crisis is not going to last forever. We are beginning to enter into a recovery phase, and there will be a recovery. We don't know how long that'll take, but it'll be there. But really think about, what are some of the best practices that you've created? If you sped up your grant making, you removed restrictions, you made it easier for nonprofits to apply, you developed more trusting relationships with your grantees. What are some of those practices that you've created? And how can you maintain that momentum going forward so that you seal those watertight doors behind you and don't slide back to your old ways, but think about some of the new ways that you can banish delusional altruism and transform your giving. So again, I just want to end by sharing with you the website for the book is delusionalaltruism.com. You can have links there to order the book. And also, there is a free downloadable discussion guide I mentioned earlier. If you scroll down to the resources section, you can find that and download it for free and use that as a guide to help you have conversations about how to transform your giving. You can always reach me on my website, putnam-consulting.com. So don't ever hesitate to reach out and see if there are ways that I can be helpful to you. Thank you so much.